From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the world holds its collective breath in anticipation of war, hundreds of journalists are filing into divisions of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines as embeds. The military's new accessibility has been hailed by news organizations, but some reporters waiting to decamp with the troops are torn between enthusiasm for the assignment and the risk it may pose, not just to life and limb, but to journalistic objectivity. NPR's John Burnett has been embedded with the Marines, and he joins us on the line from Kuwait City. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Brooke.
Where are you standing right now?
I'm actually standing on the front porch of the Hilton Hotel in Kuwait City, which overlooks the Persian Gulf. And we're sitting here waiting to embed with the troops, watching the waves and waiting for our call.
What is the role of the battalion that you'll be embedded with?
I'm going to be with the headquarters command of the 1st Marine Division, which is going to be the brain of a frontline spearheading force that is going to be one of the first over the border into Iraq if this war takes place. So I think it's going to be a great place to be to get a bit of a larger picture. And that's one of the toughest things about covering this is every reporter will only see what his unit sees, and we are locked into our units. The embed rules say you may not leave. You can't go wander off into an Iraqi village and interview people about, you know, have you had any civilians hurt? Are you turning against Saddam? We can't do that. We have to stay with our military unit.
The non-embedded reporters will do that.
Yeah, I love this, the military language. They're calling them unilateral reporters. So the unilateralists, like Mike Schuster, who's in Kuwait right now with us, and as soon as the front moves into Iraq and, quote, liberated Iraq is behind him, Mike is going to get in as quick as he can, and he's going to get to Basra, and he's going to get into the Mesopotamian Valley, and he's going to find out what has been the impact of this invasion on the civilian population. You know, he'll balance out what we're seeing.
I hear something flying overhead.
Yeah, there's a big Air Force jet flying over. This happens all day long.
You've already got a hint of how you'll be functioning on a day-to-day basis. Anything to give you concern?
Yeah, we had a meeting here in Kuwait City with some of the public affairs people with the military last weekend, and some of the Q&As they had emailed to us said that you will all have an escort while you're in the theater of operations. And, whoa, what's this? I mean, any reporter who gets an escort is immediately suspicious that this is a minder. This is someone who's going to be, you know, the eyes and ears of the Pentagon. And so I raised that with the Marine public affairs guy who will sort of be in charge of us. And he said, let me tell you about escorts. An escort is somebody I pay $75 a night for and take to a hotel room. I don't care for escorts. Ha, ha, ha. The press laughed it up. And then he followed up and said, what you're going to have is a Marine buddy. And so all the laughing stopped. And we all looked at each other and, what is a Marine buddy? And he said, this Marine buddy is going to be assigned to each one of you, and he's going to keep you safe, and he's going to explain how we war fight, and he's going to help you get interviews, and you'll be glad you have him. We're very curious what our Marine buddies are going to be like. However, I've heard from some veteran defense correspondents who've worked around the Marines that they want to get their story out, and it mainly involves just getting you to places for interviews.
I just wonder what the story that they want to get out, how that would necessarily coincide with a reporter's. I was watching Nightline the other night, and they had a report from one of their embedded reporters in Kuwait. He couldn't talk about what their operational plans were, naturally and appropriately. And so basically, ABC had to get its money's worth. So this guy filmed the Marine getting a picture of his new baby and handing out cigars and smoke them if you got them. And it was all very cozy. And don't we love our boys? And of course, that goes without saying. Is that the message, though, we'll be receiving day after day from costly embedded reporters because there's nothing else to report?
Clearly, that's part of what's happening here. I mean, that's part of what they're doing. There will be things that happen that the Pentagon will not be happy about. They're going to be showing their warts on this. They're embedding 800 reporters. They've never had this scale of the eyes of the media watching them before. And so they're nervous also that it's going to be, you know, making sausage, and we're going to see like never before what goes into fighting a war, the mistakes and the successes.
Are you concerned that you'll come to love your military colleagues, your comrades, so much that you'll be less inclined to report the warts?
You really get to the heart of what my greater concern is. I'm not as worried about how the Pentagon wants to control our message. I'm more concerned about human nature and what's going to happen to me when we get in a combat situation and we are with these men and women who are fighting and there's incoming and they may have to save my life. How much am I going to identify with them? One of the things that a veteran war correspondent told us when we trained at Fort Benning to do this is the greatest threat out there is to remember you're not one of them. You have to retain your independence and you can't get subsumed into the whole military culture. I'm very mindful of that, and I'm going to be listening to myself and to the tone of my stories to hope that they are independent, but that's definitely a concern.
John, thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Brooke. It's good to be on the show, and we'll talk later.
NPR reporter John Burnett is stationed with the Marines in Kuwait. He'll be checking in with us from time to time over the next few weeks.
A Vermont bookseller called Bear Pond Books recently destroyed its records on customer purchases, a move that will harm its ability to market to its clientele based on their demonstrated reading preferences. But the proprietor felt this preemptive measure was necessary to protect customers against government surveillance under provisions of the Patriot Act. Around the country, librarians and booksellers are increasingly alarmed by a section of the act that permits law enforcement, with a minimum of probable cause, to monitor such lists, as well as libraries' computer hard drives. This week, Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders introduced legislation that would erase the act's most intrusive elements. He joins me now. Congressman Sanders, welcome to OTM.
Good. It's nice to be with you.
Your bill would reverse some elements in Section 215 of the Patriot Act. What exactly does 215 give the federal government license to do?
What it would do is allow the FBI and other government agencies, using very, very weak standards for probable cause, to come into our library and say, we want to know what books Mr. Jones took out, or we are going to place a device on your computer so that we will be monitoring the websites that Mr. Jones visits. And by the way, it is against the law for you, librarian, to tell Mr. Jones that we are investigating him.
Or to fight the subpoena to begin with, or even to tell anybody about it.
That's right. And the same rule and law applies to booksellers.
Is it unusual to have a piece of legislation to remedy another piece of legislation that's only recently passed?
Well, I suppose in some sense it is, but obviously this piece of legislation came into existence under very unusual circumstances. I think what has happened is that a year later, people began to ask some hard questions. What was in the USA Patriot Act that passed the House without any amendments being allowed? What are some of the civil liberties problems in that bill?
This president's father helped himself get elected by accusing his opponent, that was Michael Dukakis, of being a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. And it was said as an epithet, and it stuck as an epithet. I think it's hard to explain to Americans why civil liberties are so important. They may enjoy them, but they think that only somebody else needs to be protected from government intrusion. Only bad guys have to worry about that stuff. And if they go about their business and keep their nose clean, their civil liberties will never be infringed. Is this a difficult sell just to the ordinary American?
Well, I think you raise a very good point. I mean, I think when you fight about the need for health care for all people, or lower cost prescription drugs, or raising the minimum wage, there is a built-in constituency there of millions and millions of people. I do hope and believe, however, that when people hear that the FBI or other government agencies can simply walk into a library with a very low threshold of probable cause and ask for your reading records, people say, well, wait a second, that's not what we want to see in this country. Should, if the FBI has strong evidence that they're following a terrorist, should they have the right to do that? Well, in fact, they have always had the right to do that. And we bring us back to the old threshold. So the question is not whether we give up our capability to investigate terrorism. We have got to have that. But can we continue the effort against terrorism without abrogating basic civil liberties in this country? And I think we can.
What about the politics of this? Do you believe there are members who may be sympathetic with the notion of not infringing on civil liberties, but who would fear to vote for the bill knowing that there'll be an election in 18 months' time and they'll be painted as soft on terrorism?
Yeah, I would say that will be the major obstacle that we have. But I think that many members in Congress perceive that the USA Patriot Act has gone too far, including going too far in this particular section. Bottom line here is that what librarians and booksellers, and I think a number of us in Congress, fear is that if people believe that the FBI is looking over your shoulder in terms of the books that you're reading or the books that you are purchasing, you are going to begin perhaps to change your reading habits. You really wanted to get that book on terrorism. You're interested in the issue. You may not get it. You were interested in studying Islam. Well, maybe you're not going to get that. Maybe some books in nuclear power or chemistry or anarchism or whatever it may be, because you just may have in the back of your mind the possibility that somebody may associate your reading habits with the belief that you might be a terrorist. So I think that, that puts a real chilling impact on intellectual curiosity in America, and something we don't want to see.
Well, Congressman Sanders, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. This is a very important issue, and I appreciate your interest.
Bernie Sanders is an independent congressman from Vermont.
Coming up, The Printed Word. Magazines sell smartly. You can't tell a book industry by its cover. And Oprah takes on the classics.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Conventional wisdom holds that in an age of anxiety, mindless entertainment reigns. But the sales of magazines on newsstands tell a different story. As reporter David Carr observed recently in the New York Times, America seems to be of two minds, one blatantly escapist, but the other loaded with gravitas. A good example of the former is Us Weekly, which sells 500,000 newsstand copies a week. But though Us Weekly wipes the floor with the likes of the Atlantic Monthly, the circulation of the 145-year-old Atlantic is extraordinarily spry, with a 52% increase in sales. And magazines like Mother Jones, The New Republic, and Harper's are also doing very well indeed. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brooke.
So before we make too much of this, I should probably reiterate that Us sells nine times more than the Atlantic and far outpaces the brain trust journals that I just mentioned. So this isn't necessarily a question of the smart magazines selling well, right? It's just that they're selling a lot better.
If you look at it in relative terms, these magazines are showing real increased newsstand does that turn them into Maxim or Sports Illustrated or other magazines that sell huge on the magazine stand? No. But it does indicate that Americans, at least when they're out making a magazine purchase, which is really the ultimate impulse buy, you're walking by, you take a look, you see something that interests you. Apparently what's interesting a lot of Americans is fairly substantial issues.
So what do you think seems to be going on here? Is all this impulse buying of serious magazines a manifestation of what we could call the CNN syndrome, you know, more people tuning in when there's something to tune in for?
I think the same thing that has you hitting the remote and spending more time with the news stations indeed has you, when you're at the newsstand, picking up and opening and sometimes purchasing more serious magazines.
One of the editors that you interviewed in your story had the bald-faced temerity to suggest that these magazines are just being better written and better edited than they used to be.
I think it's absolutely true. I think times like this bring out the best in journalists. I think for much of the late 90s, the work they did seemed very much beside the point. We were mostly covering how people got rich, much richer than any working journalist, of course. And you could almost see the boredom and resentment in their copy. Now it's back in our wheelhouse, if you will, at the things we're good at. And I think that people, if you look at the New York Times Magazine, if you look at the New Yorker, the Atlantic, the Harper's, I myself am finding plenty more to read than I did 4 years ago. I think people are stepping up to the plate.
I thought it was interesting that the magazines with really long stories like The Atlantic or The New Yorker are doing so well, when magazines that offer crisper, faster, more timely treatments of the news like Time and Newsweek are experiencing some serious drop-off at the newsstands.
Part of what's going on at the weeklies is when their newsstand figures come out, they're being compared to the period of June through December of 2001, and that included a very seismic event, and weeklies tend to capture the most in terms of newsstand sales when the news is high tempo and very busy. Nothing has, in a sense, happened since then, but it seems like a lot might happen, and people are looking to magazines that will help them see over the hill, help them anticipate what might be to come, and those are very complicated issues that are often rendered in very long form, and people seem to have the appetite for it.
But, my goodness, we shouldn't conclude from any of this that America is suddenly getting serious, though.
All you have to do is look at television, Brooke. The things that are selling on TV definitely represent an emphasis on escapism, pure fun, eye candy. People, when they're turning on the television set as opposed to opening a magazine, they definitely seem to be interested in forgetting what's going on in the outside world.
Right. I mean, according to my rough calculation, the final episode of Joe Millionaire drew about 30 million people, and it would take The Atlantic about half a century to sell that many copies.
Well, you're a much better math person than I am, but I think that the idea that mass sells better than class was firmly established by P.T. Barnum and others. And so even though magazines don't have the incredibly large numbers, we're talking about a fairly rarefied demographic. They represent only a slice of America, but it's a very important one, and it shows what's on top of mind of some of the more serious people in our culture.
But going back to what we noted at the top of the interview, when we say that America is of two minds, a lot of times that double mind can exist within the same individual.
I think that's fundamentally a human imperative. I spent the day yesterday on a long, serious story that involved a lot of emotions and a lot of important historical facts. And then at 7 o'clock, I left here and went and watched The Donnas, which is an all-female rock band, and just jumped around and screamed my head off. And I think those two imperatives can reside in the same person.
Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Brooke.
David Carr reports on the media for The New York Times.
After Random House publisher Ann Godoff was summarily dismissed recently for the stated reason of failing to meet profit expectations of German parent Bertelsmann, there was much hand-wringing about the state of the publishing industry. Following years of publishing house consolidation and the emergence of retail superstores, Gadoff's firing was cited as proof positive that the corporate Philistines had triumphed over the besieged defenders of literary values. And a quick glance at the USA Today bestseller list, or any other list for that matter, would seem to support the prophecies of literary doom. Number one, Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution. Number two, John Grisham's King of Torts. Number three, mass market thriller Portrait in Death. Number four, Atkins for Life. Number five, James Patterson branded pulp thriller Second Chance. In the top 50, there are only 8 titles of literary fiction or serious nonfiction. Last year, the industry turned out a record 145,000 titles, but sales and marketing budgets were dominated by a relative few.
A lot of the books that are being published get lost. You have a kind of white noise, static effect, and you have a situation of, you know, haves and have-nots.
Gail Feldman is author of Best and Worst of Times, a monograph about the industry's last 27 years of evolution. Her study documents the changes in ownership, distribution, finance, and marketing that have fed the phenomenon of blockbuster publishing, sometimes to the detriment of more intellectual work. The changes include such varying factors as the ever-growing cult of celebrity to the way books get display space in chain stores.
There's very much an aspect of the real estate business. Publishers these days have to pay for display space. The books that are in the window, the books that are in special promotions, they are all paid for.
Even if a first novel or serious biography is well-reviewed in the New York Times Book Review, for example, there's no guarantee a browser will encounter it at a Borders or Barnes & Noble. Jason Epstein, former editorial director of Random House, founder of the New York Review of Books and author of Book Business, says modern book retailing depends on fast turnover of inventory, a demand antithetical to the discovery and cultivation of non-populist books, but one the publishers are obliged to satisfy.
You have to remember that 40 years ago in the business, we had about 4,000 independent bookstores. And the sales reps could go to those bookstore owners and sit down with them and tell them about the wonderful book they just read and take a chance on it. A number of those independent bookstores would take that chance. Some of them would actually read the books and tell their customers about them. And that's how writers like Faulkner and Fitzgerald, for that matter, found their market eventually. You can't do that now. The retail market doesn't permit that.
It's harder and harder to break new people out.
Agent Jonathan Lazier, who represents such authors as Jane Goodall, Al Franken, and NPR's Scott Simon.
I have a client right now who has written these two novels are brilliant, and the first one I can't give away. I cannot sell it for $2,000. His second novel, he's just finishing, I don't have much hope for. I don't understand when quality at this level, and I've read many, many thousands of books, quality at this level is not being snapped up quickly. I can't find a place for him, and there's something wrong with that.
The most prosperous large publisher at the moment is HarperCollins, owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. And it's writing a list of bestsellers such as Michael Crichton's Prey, 8 Minutes in the Morning, and Angels Everywhere. Its profit margin of 12% dwarfs its competitors and the one-digit margins of industry tradition. Jane Friedman is HarperCollins president and CEO.
We have become a business, and I expect of the people who work for me what News Corporation expects of me. And I feel very comfortable in running a business that can have profit margins that are in the double digits.
But Friedman dismisses as absurd any notion that the profit imperative is stifling literary expression. If anything, she says, the explosion in the number of works published, the similar explosion in the number of books sold, and the rise of the internet have increased opportunities to be published and to be discovered. It's an argument certain to generate snorts of derision among gifted authors who can't get a second novel published because sales of the first were too paltry, or who can't get marketing support for a nonfiction work because they're not TV adorable enough for a book tour. But it is a view that Friedman by no means espouses alone.
Today, the ability of readers to hear about books that they want to read and to go out and get them is just so much greater than it has ever been. You know, when a great book starts to be read, you know, word gets around like wildfire in a way that has never happened before.
Daniel Simon is the founder of independent publisher Seven Stories Press, which publishes an eclectic list of poetry, nonfiction, and literary fiction. Consolidation and conglomeration, he says, have altered the ecology of publishing for sure, but one of the consequences is a new flourishing of small and not-so-small independent presses who do have the patience and sensibilities to cultivate talent. And their success in turn encourages large houses, including HarperCollins, to keep in print more enduring works that will be available long after Along Came the Spider and Who Moved My Cheese are distant memories, because, Simon says, the demand for ideas will never be suppressed.
Books are deeply trusted in our society. They are agents of change. They change hearts and they change minds.
So what if others just titillate, motivate, and entertain? In publishing and every other marriage of art and commerce, populist tastes have always lorded over more rarefied ones. Valley of the Dolls and The Joy of Sex were not published by Rupert Murdoch or Bertelsmann. Gail Feldman's monograph quotes a famous publisher about the, quote, processed, stylized, syndicated, serialized, Hollywoodized bastardization of American literature. That publisher was Max Schuster, co-founder of Simon & Schuster, in 1945. And while it may be charming and romantic to remember a legacy of tweedy book lovers and their 5% margins, meager profitability is not necessarily an indication of literary merit. Such untweedy concepts as inventory management, marketing, and return on investment may be just the tonic for the chronically anemic industry, which is why publishing consultant Lorraine Shanley is not only not in despair, she's bullish about the future of publishing and the best works of literature that flow from it.
Clearly, you're not going to get me to shed a crocodile tear over the state of the business. There were 145,000 titles published last year. So it's hard to think that because a few mass market books have risen to the top of the mass market list, we should be concerned about the future of good writing. It's all out there. It's simply a matter of finding it and cherishing it.
Although if you do, grab a second copy, because chances are that little gem you cherish will soon be out of print.
One of the great publishing phenomena of all time was a little TV talk show segment called Oprah's Book Club, launched in 1996. Every one of the 48 books discussed and recommended by the great and powerful Oprah Winfrey became a bestseller. Oprah's Book Club functioned as a veritable launching pad for new fiction, which, as we've just heard, can have a hard time getting off the ground. But she shuttered the club last April because she said, "It has become harder to find books that I feel absolutely compelled to share." Recently, cheers resounded throughout the publishing industry when Oprah announced that she is relaunching the series, only this time she'll be visiting the classics. Look for Dickens and Hemingway, not Jonathan Franzen or Joyce Carol Oates, or for that matter, Tawny O'Dell, whose first book, Back Roads, became a bestseller thanks to Oprah. Liza Dawson of Liza Dawson Associates was the literary agent on Back Roads, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did Oprah's book club change the way that people marketed their books?
It became a definition of a book, so that there was a certain kind of fiction that 20 years ago would have been called mid-list, you know, intelligent, literary, women's fiction. And there was a period of about 10 or 15 years where most publishers weren't buying that kind of book because they didn't know how to sell it. So to be able to call a book an Oprah-type book gave publishers a handle for a book when they went into Barnes & Noble.
So that was something of the impact among publishers.
Mm-hmm.
What about the impact among readers?
Well, it was pretty exciting. I think that as a result, readers became very sensitized to the notion of a book club. And it's become quite a wonderful social phenomena out there to be part of a book club.
Well, what do you think about this new series that Oprah is calling Traveling with Classics?
Mm-hmm. I'm delighted because what it's going to do is send people into the bookstores. And anytime you've got somebody in there going in to look for Anna Karenina, they're probably not going to just walk out with one book. They're going to be standing there at the section, and they're going to be looking for Bridget Jones.
So you think that it'll still have maybe a trickle-down effect on the market for new fiction. But as someone who works with new authors, aren't you loath to see Oprah promoting the classics rather than the new works that might otherwise get no attention?
Well, you know, I don't think that Oprah has a responsibility to support the publishing industry's new writers.
Sure, she does.
But, you know, you have to remember, she hasn't done this for almost a year. We didn't think she was going to be doing this at all. So I think from a publishing sense, you take what you can get.
So how do you see the publishing industry reacting to Oprah's interest in the classics?
Well, you know, if I were a business manager at any one of these mainstream houses, I'd be very excited. I mean, in some ways, she's spreading the wealth because a lot of these classic books are published by six or seven houses. You know, take Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage. I happen to know that five houses have it in print. So it's one house isn't going to be able to print 700,000 copies and reap all the benefits. It's going to be spread more equitably across all lines.
What about the used bookshops that still struggle now but might actually experience a boost?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. I like the sound of that.
As a literary agent, you're liking the sound of a boost for secondhand bookshops is positively heretical.
Again, it brings people into the bookstores. Anytime bookstores become a place for community and discussion, that's great for the industry.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Liza Dawson is a literary agent, and she joined me on the line from her office in New York. Oprah's new book club is being called Traveling with the Classics.
Coming up, a political rivalry may change the course of deregulation at the FCC, and some war stories from the inner city.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. High drama was the order of the day at the FCC last month after a puzzling vote on telephone deregulation. It left critics, lobbyists, and probably the commissioners themselves wondering what will happen in the upcoming crucial vote on broadcast deregulation, specifically that concerning media ownership. So far, the momentum has been toward easing ownership limits, favored by FCC Chairman Michael Powell, who was handpicked by the Bush administration, and his position seemed certain to prevail with three Republicans and only two Democrats on the five-person commission. But that was until the unexpected vote on February 20th, when Republican Commissioner Kevin Martin voted with the Democrats. Martin, a commissioner since the spring of 2001, may be positioning himself as a swing voter, and if that's the case, then broadcast regulation may be up for grabs. Joining us now on the line is Cable World Senior Editor Alicia Mundy. Alicia, welcome back to the big show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back again.
Why don't we begin with just a description of the recent vote and what was at stake here?
The recent vote at the FCC, it's very complex. It has to do with telephone regulation. Basically, it came out as a vote in favor of AT&T over the local Bells. It doesn't help the Bell telephones that much, and as proof of that, within hours of the vote on February 20th at the FCC, telecom stocks tanked about $15 billion.
It was an intriguing scenario because the swing vote was the Republican member Kevin Martin, who voted with the two Democratic commissioners, and he, of course, will also be the swing vote, presumably, in the upcoming decision on broadcaster regulation.
Nobody can explain what's going on here. Kevin Martin is a very conservative Republican. The two Democrats he voted with are not conservative Democrats. They're your basic New Dealer Democrats. What you've got is a situation where everyone in Washington wants to know, is this a sign of things to come for all of the big media ownership issues?
One of the other things that people in Washington seem to be asking is, where was the White House during all of this? What can we divine from the fact that the White House sat on its hands and let Commissioner Powell undergo such a public loss?
Frankly, the White House has been AWOL on telecom policy since day one, which is not real great because that's 17% of our economy. You'd like them to be a little more engaged. But people thought the White House just had other issues to deal with. The way this happened, however, with this vote, it appears that the White House may have been, how shall we say, proactively disengaged. Karl Rove is very close to the chief lobbyist for AT&T, which again is the company that's probably the big winner on that vote. In fact, the wife of one of the main AT&T officials in Washington, D.C., was until a couple of weeks ago, I'm told, working with the White House on legislative affairs. So there's a real question here as to whether the White House was sending a subtle signal or not so subtle signal that it prefers Kevin Martin. Kevin Martin's wife works at the White House. And was this the White House's way of basically cutting Michael Powell's knees out from under him?
Well, as we look forward to the FCC's action on broadcast deregulation, the further consolidation of media properties hangs in the balance. Is there anything we can divine from what happened in the telecom case about whether the White House will support Chairman Powell and his deregulatory-minded position, or whether they're going to once again leave him swinging in the wind?
Well, that's a good question, because early on the White House made it clear they wanted Michael Powell to deregulate. So now no one knows where the White House is coming from here. In anticipation of this interview, I went back and looked at some of Kevin Martin's statements and votes that had seemed odd. And at one point he appeared to be positioning himself as the consumer commissioner at the FCC. You could see Kevin Martin standing in the way of deregulation here, which could be very interesting. And I think he's a very ambitious young man who believes in his heart that he probably should have been chairman of the FCC. I think he feels he's very smart and that he should probably have the job. And it's very hard to tell what he genuinely believes in, except in the vote for the moment. And that makes him scary if you're trying to plot these things out.
One thing that is clear is that what seemed to be a near certainty just a few weeks ago that the FCC would eventually rule for more deregulation and therefore for more media consolidation, it's not clear-cut at all anymore, is it?
I don't think we had any idea we were going to be having this much fun. I mean, everybody's going back to check the cards they're holding in their hands right now to see if they still have them.
Right. Well, Alicia Mundy, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cable World Senior Editor Alicia Mundy is also a contributor to Editor and Publisher and the Columbia Journalism Review.
In Chicago, public housing residents have a newspaper they can call their own. Residents' Journal is written, edited, distributed, and read by people who live in public housing. For its writers, the paper means power. For its 35,000 readers, the bi-monthly tabloid is a crucial news source, breaking stories about the segregated low-income communities that Chicago's big daily papers often ignore. On the Media's Ron Feimster has the story.
Eitan Michaeli, the publisher of Residents' Journal, landed his first writing job right out of college at the Chicago Defender. He covered public housing at the 100-year-old daily that serves the black community of Chicago.
The Defender, unlike most publications these days has an editorial platform. It's a black perspective, and there is a real sense of dedication and mission, really, at The Defender that you don't find at other publications.
His 5 years at The Defender gave Michaeli a new understanding of his parents' tales of segregation in the Jewish ghettos of Budapest, Hungary. When he started Residence Journal, he recruited residents as reporters, inviting people to tell their own stories.
I think if you're a good journalist, you're going to find the stories that outrage you. It's no fun to write about stories that don't inspire your passion.
Mary Johns first walked into the office with a tale of bursting pipes that sent giant icicles cascading through the hallways and down the side of her high-rise building. That was 6 years ago. Today, as editor-in-chief, she is creating a broader vision for the paper.
We really like to focus on all low-income issues. Chicago Housing Authority, because that was the initial mission. Then we follow health care issues, Medicaid for the seniors, and how they have to decide if they're going to pay the rent or pay their medicine. And we write about welfare reform.
The paper's four staffers and most of the 30 freelancers have personal experience with the biggest issue in Chicago public housing, relocating tenants whose high-rise buildings were demolished to make way for new developments.
I told you I was coming to check it out.
Reporter Beauty Turner went through it. On this crisp winter day, she drops in on Ella Washington, a tenant who was moved out of public housing and into a hastily renovated duplex with an absentee landlord.
I want to know what's going on with you. That's my story. My story is what's with Ella Washington. I want to know about the gas. I was talking about this $900-and-some-dollar bill. That's what we want to talk about, this light bill that you got.
Beauty Turner broke a story of unpaid utility bills that was picked up by Chicago's daily papers and found its way to the policy think tanks of Washington, D.C. A year ago, Turner reported that Commonwealth Edison never turned out the lights on people who skipped utility payments at Robert Taylor Homes, the legendary crime-ridden development where she lived for 11 years. The bills kept climbing, and ultimately, they followed residents into the private housing market.
Some of us receiving Section 8 vouchers, and they moving out into these big houses with high, extremely high light bills. And what you're ending up with is about 6 months down the road, Commonwealth Edison asks for their money, they don't have it. The relocation contract stipulates that they need their utilities paid, and they end up homeless.
Author Alex Kotlowitz subscribes to Residents Journal, which he calls his eyes and ears inside the developments run by the Chicago Housing Authority.
I used a story that appeared in Residence Journal and began to question the director about it, and the head of media relations said to me, oh, well, you know, that's just them, sort of writing them off. A couple of weeks later, I got a call, essentially an apology, that in fact they realized that what they had written was right on target.
Catherine Greenberg, the head of media relations at the CHA, has come to respect the reporters of Residence Journal and to be careful when she takes their calls.
Not that you're not honest with everybody that calls, but when a resident calls, they know what they're talking about. And so I think that you have to listen to them. You have to take it very seriously.
Residence Journal is a relentless critic of the Housing Authority, but it also publishes service pieces, including an occasional guide to the Housing Authority's daunting paperwork. For example, the editors worked with residents to create an insert that explained a relocation survey. Megan Hart is the CHA's Managing Director for Resident Services.
It was the first step in helping CHA break down the relocation contract in the survey to a level where it makes it understandable to the resident. Some of the things that Beauty has done, she has called me and has really helped us deal with actual individual cases.
What do you want to happen now?
The only thing I really wanted to do is have repairs done, and my bill was reduced.
Ella Washington leads Turner through the apartment, pointing out problems in every room. Paint chips that might be lead, cracked plaster, electrical problems, a faulty stove, spongy floorboards in the pantry, rats, no doorknob on the fire door.
But have you ever asked them for your moving papers? So
I ask for moving papers.
Better.
Every time I get the moving papers, it'd be a dilemma with the bills. The bills are extremely high.
Beauty Turner never writes that story, but it turns out she doesn't have to. When she begins making inquiries,
write this number down.
The landlord decides to make repairs. Ella Washington moves on with her life. Beauty Turner works the phones on a new story.
Name Beauty, like Beauty Shop Beauty Turner. Okay?
You got me? Okay, I got you.
For On the Media, I'm Ron Feimster.
To outsiders, the inner city is a foreign land with its own rules and its own language. But the right guide, like journalist Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, can take us there and show us what we could never see for ourselves. Her book, called Random Family, follows an extended family in their ordinary everyday struggle for happiness over the course of 11 years. It wasn't what LeBlanc originally intended. She went to the trial of a Bronx drug dealer to write about his life. But in the courtroom, she met his girlfriend Jessica and her brother Caesar, and through them his girlfriend Coco, and Coco introduced her mother Foxy and a wide extended family. She chronicled their lives day by day. Without a single pious pronouncement or judgment, Random Family brings us close to a real understanding of people we might never fathom. We follow their mistakes, the ones that seem so obvious to us, children having children, dropping out of school, taking drugs. And finally, we understand why they make them. It transforms the reader, and the writer, too. Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here.
So, to us, your book represents an extreme example of a certain kind of risky journalism. It seemed that you were the master of the telling detail, the brand of candy that people like to buy, the brands of shoes, and not just the consumer goods, but the color that they chose for their curtains. You couldn't have conveyed the life of your subjects with so much clarity if you hadn't become their friends.
I think that's very true. I feel it would be hard to make readers care about anything, really, if as a writer you didn't care deeply about it yourself.
I guess that's why I wonder, were any of these characters, some of whom had so much compassion and empathy, did they ever worry about you?
I think I know that Caesar said to me toward the end of when I'd finished the book, you know, he said to me, I wonder what you're going to do without us.
Caesar is the brother of Jessica, another
character.
Yes,
and Coco's first love and the father of several of her children. And he and I had a very slow courtship and eventually became extremely close. And he's incarcerated. And the large part of our relationship was over the telephone. You know, he would often say to me, you need to spend more time with your man, because my primary energy was really given over to the reporting much of the time. And I think he understood more about my life in a way, or he was paying attention to my life in a way that I had ceased to.
So is there any particular story you can tell me where your role as a friend conflicted with your role as a journalist?
One of the most dramatic moments in the book, perhaps, is, you know, when Caesar accidentally shoots his best friend, and for months, that scene was really just a few brief sentences. And my editor was emphatic that I open the scene up. It was an incredible moment for him. It ends up being the thing that sort of turns him around in prison, what he learns from this loss. And I tend to be resistant to naturally dramatic moments because of the risk of cliche and all of that. But I later came to understand that part of my resistance was that it was such a painful subject for Caesar that I really dreaded having to ask him the straightforward questions. And I think that's where my friendship with him made me acutely sensitive to some of those issues.
And as a result, that story really does only occupy a couple of sentences in the book.
That's right. That's right.
Can you give me an example of a time when your particular concern about your version of the story clashing with theirs or possibly having consequences beyond the book gave you pause?
It's not an obvious moment, but for example, the scene toward the end of the book where Coco's apartment is utterly infested by roaches, I worried myself sick about including that scene because she worked so hard to keep her apartment clean, and it was such a fundamental way in which she spent a lot of her effort and time. And I felt it would be very shaming for her to have her house betrayed in a way that many, I believe, middle-class people would interpret to have to be about not keeping a clean house, when in fact it was an issue about substandard housing and a bad landlord. But what was interesting is when we spoke about the scene, she was excited that I was going to put it in because she said, you know, that lady never calls me back and it's not my fault. And I'm happy that she ought to be ashamed of herself for letting my children live with these roaches.
Characters like Coco, starting out in their early or mid-teens, are full of optimism and they're buoyant and they're resilient. And then as time goes on, as time for Coco went on, she became prematurely middle-aged. Her patience ran out. Her endless struggle to make good for herself and good for her children mm-hmm. wore her down. You know, these people changed over time, and presumably so did you.
I'm being weaned of this, but friends of mine have said to me that I for a period of time became very sarcastic, deeply cynical. So I certainly was affected by the fog of despair that I describe.
Any regrets about choices you made, about what to put in the book and what to leave out?
I've wondered, have I captured the joyfulness of these lives? Because so many people are responding to the hardship, but there was so much joy there as well. And one thing that I tried to do is to show how the mothers, who in the beginning of the book are really grandmothers by that point, were the young woman that you meet in the narrative. So that Foxy was the exuberant Coco at one point in her life, and that there are sort of ghost moments of that resilience, what I put in quotes, because I think at the end of the day what I'm saying is damaging circumstances do damage, and no amount of resilience is going to trump impossibility.
I noticed that in January you had an article in the New York Times Magazine where you chronicled lives similar to those in your book. And you got to wonder, are you obsessed? Can you not let this thing go?
I certainly have other interests and am looking forward to doing pieces on other subjects. But I know when I'm on the street, when I'm doing street reporting, I'm at my happiest. I feel, I mean, it sounds precious, and I don't mean it to be precious in any way, but I feel true to myself because I have very strong concerns about social injustice. So I think, you know, certainly in a very conventional sense, I feel it's a worthy place for any journalist to spend some time, and a very easy one. But I think personally, you know, I definitely have a deep sense of, I feel a deep sense of home.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc is the author of Random Family.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Irene Trudell, Rob Christensen, and Bill O'Neill. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Brian Tilley, and Mark Herz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydale Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.